Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This is a very special edition of the Tech Guy podcast. Scott Wilkinson's filling in for me. So 3 hours of home theater geeks on this show. Originally on the Premier Radio Networks, airing Sunday, June 12th, 2011. This is episode 778. Enjoy.
Well, hello there. A good day to you. It's Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek, sitting in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Of course, Leo covers the entire tech universe, computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, anything with a chip in it, as he says. Whereas I concentrate on home theater, flat panel TVs, audio video receivers, speakers, Blu-ray, online content, as well as movies, both at home and in the commercial cinema. I like to think of it as covering the newest technology used in one of humanity's oldest pastimes. No, it's not what you think. Storytelling. All human societies have included storytelling as a central part of their culture, but the way in which those stories are conveyed has been evolving from sitting around a campfire to sitting around the electronic hearth, be it at home or in a large commercial theater. The technology has been evolving at an ever-increasing rate, too, so it's getting mighty confusing for folks out there. So my job is to eliminate as much of that confusion as I can. So that's what I'm here for. Most of the time, I do that online at my online homes, ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. But today, here I am, on the radio with you. And you can call me at 8888-ASK-LEO, which, of course, is Ask Scott today. That's 888-827-5536. Now, regular listeners of The Tech Guy know that Leo and I disagree about one of the hottest trends in home theater, 3D. Leo, of course, thinks it's a gimmick, not very important. He wishes it would go away. Whereas I really like it, at least when it's done well. And that's the distinction. We've seen some really good home theater, some really good 3D, I mean, and some not so good 3D, both in the theater and at home. And I advocate for really well done 3D. Now, of course, it's a new art form. And like any new art form, people need experience, and the first efforts are going to be spotty, shall we say. Some of them will be good, some of them will be bad. I think the general trend is improving. We're getting better and better at 3D, that is, the people who are creating it, stereographers, directors, and so on. They're learning more about it, and a lot of places are offering education for those professionals. Sony and others are offering workshops, classes, seminars at how to do it well. And what does that mean? How to do it well? How do you do 3D well? Well, I like to see 3D that is more behind the screen plane. Of course, we have 2D, which is the screen. It's width and it's height. And 3D adds depth, or what we sometimes call the Z axis. And so things can be in front of the screen or they can be behind the screen. At least they can appear to be in front of the screen or behind the screen. And so I like 3D in which most of the content, most of the Z-axis is behind the screen. It gives a sense of depth without being gimmicky. And I really hate those gimmicky shots. I just saw Pirates 4, which is in 3D. I didn't think the 3D was that good, and there were quite a few what I call gimmick shots of pirates thrusting swords at you, which, you know, I can do without that. Thank you very much. But when things are behind the screen, for the most part, a little bit in front, then it can look very good. Kung Fu Panda 2 in 3D is a perfect example. I found that to be some of the best 3D I've ever seen. I wish the story had been a little better. The original Kung Fu Panda was quite good, I thought. But the second one, not so much. I mean, yeah, it's, you know, good versus evil, blah, blah, blah. But generally speaking, I didn't like the story as much. But the 3D was fabulous. And the animation was fabulous. So if you get a chance to see it, I would do so in order to see what really good 3D looks like. And when we get it on Blu-ray at home, then it's going to be great, I think. It's going to be certainly a demo disc that I'm going to use when I review TVs, which is mostly what I do at ultimateavmag.com and home theater, more at hometheater.com, which is more of a review site. I review TVs and projectors, video projectors. Those of you who have a real home theater probably have a projector firing onto a screen, and you have very good light control. That is, you can turn off the lights, and it can be very dark in there, just like it is in a commercial theater. Now, for 3D, there's two ways to do that with a flat panel or with a projector, for that matter. One is with these active shutter glasses, and I'm sure you've heard of those. They have some electronics in them. They actually alternate which lens is on or open and which lens is closed. And they do that in synchronization with the right eye image on the screen and the left eye image on the screen, and they go back and forth very fast. And this provides full resolution to each eye, but it's pretty expensive, and they're kind of heavy, they're kind of clunky, and they cost anywhere from $50 to $200 a pop. And this is one of the biggest, most vocal objections that people have to 3D at the home, in the home anyway, is, wow, those glasses are so expensive that I'll never be able to have a Super Bowl party in 3D at my home because it'd cost me hundreds or $1,000 to, you know, put these glasses on everybody at my party. So LG and Vizio have come up with an alternate, which is using passive glasses, which are the kind of glasses you get mostly when you go to the commercial theater to see 3D there. They're very light. They're non-active. They don't have any electronics. They're very inexpensive. And you can use them on a flat panel. But the problem there is that the flat panel has a fixed number of lines in the image. You've probably heard me talk about the resolution of high-def flat panels, which is typically 1920 pixels across by 1080 pixels down. Now, that's full high definition, but in a flat panel, a 3D flat panel with passive glasses, the lines, the vertical resolution, is divided in half. The odd-numbered lines are for the left eye, and the even-numbered lines are for the right eye. And so each eye only sees 540 lines, which is hardly high def. Not only that, when you sit close enough to really have an engaging 3D experience, you see these thin little black horizontal lines. And that can certainly cause some people some consternation, including me. And it works in exactly the at counter purposes to what I think is most important about 3D, which is filling your field of view, which is why I think it works so well in the commercial cinema, because the screen is so big, it fills your field of view. Whereas at home, most people sit far enough away from their TV that it does not fill their field of view. And so the 3D effect is not as immersive. It's not as engaging. So this is a bit of a problem with 3D at home, and why I might tend to agree with Leo in that 3D at home is not as effective, but I really like it in the cinema when it's done well. And I do recommend that if you haven't seen it before, you go out and check it out. This is Scott Wilkinson. I'm the home theater geek in for Leo Laporte, and we'll be back in just a moment. It's Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And the bumper music you're hearing is one of my many musical projects. It's the Southern California Early Music Consort, which has been for many years the Queen's Own Band at the Renaissance Fair in Northern and Southern California. And we, several years ago, did a recording of all the Renaissance dances that we do out there at the fair. This is the fanfare that often precedes the queen as she processes through the shire. So I don't know about you, but I want to get to some phone calls. So let's take, let's see what Roger in Lomita, California has to say. Hey, Roger, you're on with Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek. Hello, Roger. I don't hear Roger. Do you hear Roger? Nope, I guess he's gone. Well, okay, then. Let's go to Miguel in Santa Ana. Hey, Miguel, how you doing?
This is Roger in Lomita.
Oh, Roger. Boy, you know what? These buttons are flashing at me and gotten me a little confused. I'm terribly sorry. Roger in Lomita, go ahead. How are you?
Good. I heard you a couple of weeks ago on Leo, and you said you were testing the new Panasonic VT Plasma, and that's the TV I'm thinking of getting, so I want to know what you thought.
Well, yeah, it is the TV of the hour, and everyone is talking about it, and I get a lot of questions about it. There are actually, the VT30 is the 2011 version, and while we're not done with our review yet, Tom Norton is doing the primary review. But so far it looks very good. Now we did an interesting experiment where we put the ST30, which is the lowest end, 3D TV, next to the GT30, which is the midline 3D TV, next to the VT30, which is the top of the line. And also we put next to all three of those, the VT25, which was last year's top of the line. And we took a look at all of them. We fed them the same content. We took a look at all of them. Tom had calibrated them all and set up the user controls so that everything was as good as it could be. And what we found was actually pretty interesting, which is both of us actually liked the VT25, last year's model, the best.
Really?
All of them. Yes. Now, that's not to say that the VT30 isn't good. It is. It's very good. But, you know, so if you can find one, a VT25, I would say absolutely go for that. If you can't and you have the money to buy a VT30, I would say that would be your next best choice.
And are you testing the 55 or the 65?
In the case of the VT30, we're testing the 55.
Okay.
In the case of the ST30 and GT30, we're testing the 50.
Oh, okay.
So we have a slightly smaller screen size on those two.
And the VT25 from last year was a 54-inch, right?
Correct, although we had the 50-inch in our studio.
Okay. And I don't know if you they said that it has a subwoofer built in. How was the sound of it?
Well, you know what? We don't really test the sound of the TVs.
Okay.
Because we expect at that price level, and we certainly encourage people to have an external sound system, because I have yet to hear a sound system built into a TV that sounds any good at all.
Right. Even my Pioneer, it's decent, but it's not great. But I do have a soundbar question for you. You said last week that you talked to the guy who developed Definitive Technologies, and they make a soundbar, and I just wondered if you'd ever heard it.
I haven't, no. But we are going to be testing some sound bars and some lower cost speaker systems here in the near future. On hometheater.com, we're just about to start a new program wherein we will be reviewing products online, not in the print magazine, that are best sellers at various retailers, Amazon, Best Buy, Crutchfield, and so on.
Okay.
And so we're just starting that program up now. And in the next few months, you will see us be rolling out some of these reviews of best-selling products, which are typically more mass market than what the magazine tends to review.
Okay. Now, one last question. Does a soundbar hook up to a 5.0 receiver, 5.1 receiver?
It sure can, absolutely. Some soundbars have their own built-in amplifier, in which case you would send it, say, an optical or a coax digital signal from directly from the Blu-ray player or from your AV receiver.
Okay.
Or in some cases, you could send it a speaker-level signal. It depends on the soundbar. There are both.
Have you heard any real good soundbars?
Let's see. The Polk soundbar, as I recall, sounded very good. I've heard of Vizio soundbars was very good. In some cases, like in the case of Vizio, you can get the soundbar for the front, also comes with a subwoofer, and wireless surround speakers for the rear. So you don't have to have simulated surround coming from this one soundbar. You can have the front channels coming from the soundbar and the rear channels coming from real speakers. So that seems to be a pretty nice compromise solution that we will, in fact, be taking a listen to and reporting on at hometheater.com.
Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. Okay, let's see. We got next here. If I'm correct, line two is David in Columbus, Ohio. It's Scott Wilkinson, the Home Theater Geek. Hiya.
Scott, how you doing?
I'm great. Thanks.
I love your podcast, and I enjoy reading the question and answer on the Home Theater website.
Thank you. I want to make sure everyone understands this, that one of the things that I do on hometheater.com and ultimateavmag.com is I answer listener and reader questions. And so all you have to do is send me an email at scott@techguylabs.com, and I try to answer every question I get. At the moment, I'm running about 3 weeks to a month behind. As you can imagine, I get a lot of email.
Yeah, as I said, I've got a couple of just some points. First, with streaming, I've got a fairly fast internet connection, and I have a good Airport Extreme modem, and I have it hooked up to the second generation Apple TV. I've had it hooked up wirelessly and wired, but I get such a good signal strength that wireless works well. When I was talking to the person that answered the call, I said I was going to talk about the streaming negatives, and it's not so much the picture quality, because I've watched YouTube videos at 720p, and I've watched baseball games at their HD settings, and honestly, it's quite good. My concern with streaming is, number one, I'm retired, so I do a lot of my watching during the day when a lot of people at work. I think at night, when a lot of people get online and you have problems with congestion, I can only imagine that people have problems with buffering. I've seen it myself. That's why I don't think it will ever replace a good hard disk like a Blu-ray. The second thing is, even though ISPs say they don't do it, I can only imagine that if they're looking at people who are using a lot of bandwidth, that it would be very easy for them to throttle your bandwidth.
Well, certainly a lot of ISPs now are capping bandwidth, which is a big, it's a big topic that is a real problem. And 250 gigabytes or so seems like a lot, but when you're streaming high-def movies, you're going to eat up that bandwidth in a big, fat hurry.
No, that's true, and I've watched a baseball game, and for 10 minutes on an iPad, when I timed it, it would be about 3 gigs to watch.
I'm sorry, I got to cut you off right there. It's Scott Wilkinson, the Home Theater Geek, in for Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
They led us in watching the protest, urged us to care. What courage those citizens crowding to challenge their leaders. When the massacre started, we felt it as if we were there.
This episode of The Tech Guy is brought to you by DSL Extreme. For lightning-fast internet access at an amazing price, visit dslextreme.com. Welcome back. It's Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And that bumper music is from an album that my wife and I recorded some years ago in our little home studio. Most of it is written by my wife, Joanna Kasdan, who is in the chat room as we speak. Hi, hon. And that particular song is called Tiananmen Square, obviously, written about the events that happened there some time ago. And I played all of the wind instruments on the CD, including a number of them that you probably heard in the mix there somewhere or another. And that was a wonderful project for her and I to do. And so all this, all today, by the way, all the bumper music is going to be music that I have mostly that I have recorded and performed on. So I will tell you about that as we go along. So let us get back to the phones. And Sean in Temecula is up next. Hey, Sean. Scott Wilkinson, yeah. The home theater geek. How you doing?
Good. How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks.
I'm thinking about putting a TV in the man cave in the garage to watch football and stuff.
The man cave. I love it.
But I hear that plasma is the wrong thing to put in there because it gets too hot. I mean, where I live at, sometimes it'll get to be 110 degrees. Not now, but you know, typically when we have a regular summer.
Well, it's true. Temecula does get kind of hot. You won't have AC in there?
No, not at all. Just beer and a bunch of crazy guys.
Well, I think that's going to generate a little more heat than any TV you stick in there.
Yeah, the gas will be flying, I'm sure.
Well, it's true that a plasma will generate a fair amount of heat. And the new LCD TVs, at least the LED illuminated LCD TVs, probably won't generate quite as much, but still in all, you're going to have equipment in there. You're going to also have, you know, your satellite box and your speakers and an AV receiver. And, you know, all of that equipment is going to generate a fair amount of heat. So I would say I wouldn't choose a plasma or not based upon the amount of heat it generates by itself. There's going to be a lot of other factors that I think are going to overwhelm that factor.
At some point, is there going to be a wireless signal to the TV? Because I've got a smart TV now with a Samsung 55, and I get all my YouTube and all my apps wirelessly through my router. At some point, is there going to be something? Because I hate to have to start dragging a bunch of wires into the garage and doing all this stuff. It's going to be a pain.
Yeah, you can do that. It's generally not that good quality, I'll tell you. So if you're really looking for high quality, it's not going to be the best way to go. But if you're a bunch of football fans in there drinking beer and hooting and hollering, maybe the ultimate quality might not matter that much to you, in which case, you know, wireless could, in fact, work. There are a number of solutions that allow you to beam signals wirelessly from your source devices or your main home theater. On the other hand, if you're out in the garage, you're going to have several walls between your main system and the garage system. And so, you know, these wireless systems might or might not work. They all depend on what kind of obstacles are in the way. Are there a lot of walls between the main system and your garage?
Not really. My smart panel is probably about 8 feet from the garage, and there's only one wall in between it. So.
Oh, well, then it probably should work okay.
Yeah, that'd probably get a pretty decent signal.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so, yeah, sure. Sounds great, man.
Fight when the Cowboys go back to the Super Bowl.
Good luck, man.
Thanks, brother.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. Who we got next? We have Paul in Columbus, Ohio, with a media receiver question. Hey, Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Great to have you on again and doing a great job.
Thank you so much.
And this must be Columbus Day. Anyway, I've got a relatively new Denon AVR 591 receiver tuner,
mm-hmm.
Which has all HDMI connections as well as a few of the standard AV connections and a couple of components and whatever.
Sure.
And I've got UVerse cable,
mm-hmm.
I'm close to the terminal, so it's great.
Good.
And a Samsung 50-inch DLP, which I dearly love and have had for 4 years and just now have to replace the lamp in the near future.
Well, the fact that it lasted 4 years is really quite good.
Quite impressed, because we don't watch TV every minute of the day, but it's on quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but the problem that we've had since we got the Denon is that when we ran the directly into the cable box into the TV, into the receiver,
mm-hmm.
to the TV, we're not getting closed caption. If we run the TV, you know, from the box directly into the Samsung, got closed caption, no problem. And I can't find any adjustment or anything that would make any sense that would have any effect on that, because we're using the HDMI connection. The sound's fine.
Oh, yeah. It should work. That should work no problem. I don't really understand that. You know what? I will have to contact Denon and find out if they're filtering that for some reason. I can't imagine that they would be. But if they are, then that would not be a good thing. I must admit that in our receiver reviews, we do not test for this. But your call makes me think maybe we should.
Yeah, I'll tell you a reason is my mother's hearing impaired, and occasionally she's over, but usually we can use the subtitles on the discs or whatever, which are actually better than a closed caption. But occasionally we'll have we like to watch the British comedies and whatever, and sometimes the closed captioning on those are handy just because you don't always get the accents. You want to have the TV volume down and whatever.
Sure.
You know, to catch it.
Right.
Yeah, I'd really like to figure out what's going on. I called Best Buy where we got it, and of course that was kind of fruitless. But
well, you might try Denon customer service. I must admit I haven't tried their customer service line directly. I mean, I have contacts directly into a variety of manufacturers, being a journalist in the field. So I don't often have to go through real customer service, and I've heard some horror stories about some customer service systems, whereas other companies, it's quite good. So I don't know about Denon.
Okay.
You might give it a try and find out if they are filtering the closed caption signal. I can't imagine why they would do that. But if you don't get any satisfaction there, shoot me an email at scott@techguylabs.com.
Real quick follow-up, too, on another topic, but what's your preference as far as internet connection, if you don't have a DVD or one of those boxes that you're using, like a Roku or the Boxy box? What you have a preference at this point?
You mean in terms of a device to receive media,
to connect into the internet? We're using the a Wii box right now for Netflix, and it only gets like 480i. It's not. It actually doesn't look too bad on the Samsung, because it does a heck of a good job on processing, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's still not obviously high def.
Right. The best box that I have heard of, and I must admit I don't have a ton of experience myself with streaming media, but the one that everybody seems to rave about is Vudu.
Vudu. Okay.
Vudu. V-U-D-U. It's... they offer a high def service and a super high def service called HDX, which if you have enough bandwidth, you can stream that. But otherwise, it's a download file. It takes it buffers for a while. It stores someplace, and then and then you can play it. But that's the one that everybody seems to like the best. So that's what I recommend there.
Thanks very much. Have a good one.
My pleasure. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And what we're listening to right now is a brass quintet written by my good friend Steve Wilson up in Santa Cruz, California. where I went to school and we met many, many years ago. I'm playing the French horn part on the E-flat alto horn in this case. Unfortunately, we didn't get quite the right cut queued up. We'll do this another time, the second movement, which is the one I really wanted everybody to hear because it's quite lovely. And I think Kyle Benham, our wonderful board op, might be getting that up as we speak. Here it is. So as you can tell, that's a live recording, and it's a lovely piece. It's a three-movement piece, and that one we're listening to now is the second movement, on which, as I said, I play E-flat alto horn on the French horn part. And Steve is a very prolific composer, and I recently was up in Santa Cruz playing a concert of all original music with him, and I know he's listening right now. So, hey, Steve. So now we're going to go to Miguel in Santa Ana. Hey, Miguel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Hi. My question is, well, here's what happened. My mom moved into a little house in the hills of Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a TV connected to an HD receiver, like a $55 one, and with rabbit ears. And she doesn't want to pay for any cable.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with it is she only gets one channel, and it's just the Spanish channel. So I was just wondering,
does she speak Spanish?
Yes, but she wants you know, of course, the other channels, like the regular channels, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, but
okay, so she's in the hills.
Yeah, and in the hills of Orange County, like Santa Ana Heights area.
Now, when she's in the hills, is she in the west facing? Is she on a west facing slope or an east facing slope?
West facing.
Yeah, that's going to be a little bit of a problem. She'll get a better result if you put a rooftop antenna on top of the house. The rabbit ears are going to be very poor quality, and they're not going to really be able to pull in very much. I've also tried a number of dedicated what are called ATSC indoor antennas, which are intended to receive the digital TV signals, terrestrial TV signals, but I haven't found very much success with those. I have a rooftop antenna myself. Now, I'm in the flats, so I can easily point to Mount Wilson. Those of you who aren't in LA, Mount Wilson is where most of our TV transmitters are for the LA area, and I get plenty of reception. It's great. In the hills, it's more of a problem. So it's a bit of a gamble on your part. I think a rooftop antenna would do better. Even better than that would be if you could put that antenna on a mast, which is a tall thing that sticks up pretty far. And that would work really quite well, probably. But it's a lot more work.
Yeah.
So the other option, I think, would be cable or satellite. I know she doesn't want to pay for that. And over-the-air high def is really a great bargain because you don't have to pay for it. So my first suggestion would be to put an antenna on the roof and get an antenna that's specifically designed for digital TV broadcasting. Most of the digital TV stations are in the UHF band. I think there are a couple in the VHF band, but most are in the UHF band. And actually, somebody in the chat room says, nope, the LA market has both VHF and UHF. That may very well be true. somebody else in the chat room says, don't buy the $10 cheap rabbit ears. They're junk. Well, even the more expensive in-room, in-house antennas that I've tried haven't worked very well. So I think putting an antenna on the roof would be a great improvement.
How much do you think that would run, you know, for an antenna?
Good question. I haven't really done any shopping lately for rooftop antennas. I'd think you know, I would have to guess. Let's see. Here's David Bix in the chat room. By the way, the chat room is a wonderful place to go hang out during the show. You can get there by going to the website for the show, techguylabs.com. And David Bix in the chat room is saying, if they can't get a rooftop antenna, Radio Shack has a quality indoor for $40 that's adjustable with a remote and good return policy. You know, I haven't tried that particular one. Maybe it would work. I would say you'd want to spend, $50 to $100 or something. And Web911 in the chat room is mentioning antennaweb.org, which is a really great resource for terrestrial broadcasting, where you can go and find out, you can put in your location, and they'll tell you which direction to point the antenna in, and so on and so forth. So there are some resources for you right there, and I'll bet you there'll be some other comments in the chat room here, so I'd suggest logging in there and seeing what our wonderful chat room has to say about this.
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Okay, let's see. Line two, Randy in Costa Mesa. How you doing? Did I hit the right button? Randy in Costa Mesa? I guess I didn't. I did? Oh, let me hit it again. Randy, are you there? No? you know what? I'm getting an education here. Oh, Eduardo, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Eduardo, I'm sorry. I've got a brand new panel here, which is actually very old, but it's new to me because I've never used it before. So pardon my stumbling here. But hi, Eduardo. Welcome to the show. How can I help you?
It's a pleasure speaking to you. I'm looking into building, putting together my home theater system, and I want to start with a TV. I'm looking for a large TV.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing my research, but I mostly found 3D. I don't know if I want to go with a 3D television mm-hmm. just yet. So I want to see, what do you recommend? Because I want to go with a 55 or 60-inch TV to mm-hmm. start. So what are your recommendations on that?
Well, let me ask you this. How far are you going to be sitting away from the TV?
I have a room designed just for the TV, so probably it's going to be about 6-7 feet away from the TV.
Oh, pretty close. That's great. Okay. And do you have good light control in the room? Will you be able to darken the room?
Yeah. I have some recess lights so I can, and they're dim so I can, go completely dark or add some light to the room.
Excellent. Excellent. Wonderful. Okay. Well, then what I can recommend is that you get a plasma TV. And as far as 3D is concerned, the 3D has become very quickly a feature, just like online access to content and other features that you can buy with a TV. And I will tell you this, that TVs that have 3D as a feature are often the best 2D TVs.
Oh, okay.
So in other words, even if you don't want 3D right now, or you don't really care about 3D, that doesn't really matter. You can get a 3D TV and not use the 3D, and you'll have probably a better 2D experience.
Oh, okay.
So I recommend the Panasonics. Panasonic plasmas are very good. Samsung plasmas are also very good. We haven't had a Samsung plasma in the studio for a while. I'm planning to get a couple in to look at, but for the moment, I would say a plasma 55 or 60 inch, and if you get a 3D capable model, it will be a better 2D performer, generally speaking. So that's what I recommend.
Oh, okay, yeah, because I was kind of afraid that if I go 3D, I will be just stuck watching 3D content,
No.
And turn off, Greg.
No. You'll have plenty of great 2D content as well. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hello and a great good day to you. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, sitting in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And I'm taking a bunch of calls today, so we're going to get right back to them. You can call me at 888-ASK-LEO. That's 888-827-5536. Before I do take the first call, I do want to mention that at the bottom of the hour, I've got a very special guest coming in to chat with me a bit. Eisuke Tsuchizaki, the Chief Technology Officer of Panasonic North America, is going to be in to talk about Panasonic, plasmas, 3D, all that good stuff. I've got some probing questions to ask him, so we shall see how he responds. In the meantime, though, got plenty of calls waiting. I'm going to go to Bill in Hesperia. It's Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek. How you doing?
How you doing, Scott?
Doing great, thanks.
My question is about front projector screens.
Ooh, one of my favorite subjects.
I'm using a matte screen, and it seems to waste a lot of light spreading it around the room. I wonder if I'd be better off with a reflective screen, and would it have a hot spot in the center or not?
Well, it could. It depends on a number of factors. What is the screen you have now?
It's just a matte white cheap thing.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, a good projection screen has some specific properties, and there are different properties for different applications. Let me ask you this. What projector do you have?
It's a Sony 3 LCD.
3 LCD. And do you have a good light control in your room?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good. So there are a number of companies that make good projection screens. Stewart Film Screen is the most common one. But there's also Screen Innovations. There is Elite Screens. There's Daylight is another excellent screen. And one of the characteristics of projection screens is something called gain. And a lot of screens have what's called a positive gain of like 1.3, 1.5, even more. And you might wonder, well, wait a second, it's a passive thing. How can it actually amplify the light? You can't get more light off it than you're putting onto it, can you? Well, no, of course you can't. But what it does is it focuses the light in a sense. It reflects it back. As the gain gets higher, the cone in which the light is reflected back, it's narrower and narrower. So as you move off the center of the screen, it gets dimmer and dimmer. And also high gain screens do tend to have hot spotting, as you pointed out. So if you've got good light control in your room, and is your room painted a dark neutral colors or is it light?
No, it's pretty much white.
White. Well, that's a problem. So I would not get what's called a unity gain or a 1.0 gain screen. I might get a 1.3 or a 1.5, because if you get a unity gain screen, it reflects the light back at all angles. And some of those angles are going to bounce off of your white walls, and they're going to end up back onto the screen and into your eyes, and it's going to affect the contrast and the quality of the picture that you see. So with white walls, I would definitely get a screen with some gain. Stewart also makes what are called gray screens, the Greyhawk and Firehawk, and other companies make these as well, which are, and some of which are intended for use in an ambient light environment, that is with a room that has some ambient light in it. So if you're having a Super Bowl party or something like that, you might want to use one of these screens. But I would say get a screen with some gain, and you're going to be spending a little money on this. This is not necessarily cheap. We're talking probably, well, how big a screen do you want?
About a 72-inch diagonal.
Oh, well, that's not very big. As a projection screens go, that's pretty small. So I would say you're going to be in the $1,000 range for a mm-hmm. high-quality screen. But if you go to Stewart Film Screen or Daylight in particular, the two that I know best, I'm sure the others are good too, but I know those two screen companies very well, and they make excellent screens. So I would go do some research on that, and I'll bet you'll find something a lot better than what you're using now.
Would using a gray screen be an improvement I don't understand how that works.
Well, gray screens are typically screens that you want in a somewhat of an ambient light environment. At least they work a little better in that environment. They punch up the contrast some. They typically have a narrower viewing angle, which means that less of the light is bouncing off your walls and ceiling, which is what you want in your particular case. I'm not sure I would necessarily recommend a gray screen for you. I'd say if you get a white screen with some gain, that's going to serve you very well.
Okay, thanks a lot, Scott.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for calling. Okay, before we get to the next call, I think we have a word from Leo Laporte.
I do want to mention my friends at Carbonite, who do a great backup solution that you must have, Mac or PC. If you are not backing up your data off-site, you are running a great risk. It's fine to back it up to an external drive. I should have told Steve this. It's fine to back it up to an external drive sitting next to your computer. But if the worst happens, you know, there's a fire, a flood. I mean, I hate to bring up, you know, bad things like this. But if the worst happens and you don't have a backup that's off-site, you're going to lose everything. So a good backup strategy has two parts to it. One should be automatic, so you don't have to think about it. Two, it should be off-site, so that if something really horrible happens, you've got the data. This is what Carbonite does. Automatic. In fact, you could try it free for 2 weeks right now. It'll immediately start backing up using your internet connection. It doesn't slow you down or the internet, but it just it trickles the data up. Go to carbonite.com. Use the offer code Leo. You've got to be prepared, as they say, for those just-in-case moments. And that's what Carbonite does for you. Easy to get started. It'll back up your files, unlimited backup of all your personal data on your internal drive for just $55 a year. And it's all available to you at any time just by logging into your Carbonite account on your Mac, your Windows machine, even on the free iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry apps they offer. Carbonite.com, free 15-day trial. And if you decide to buy, use Leo once again as the offer code, and you'll get an additional 2 months on your one-year subscription, 14 months for the price of 12. Carbonite, CARBONITE.com. Offer code Leo. You got to back it up to get it back, so do it right with Carbonite.
Thank you so much, Leo Laporte. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy, this lovely Sunday afternoon. We're getting a lot of chatter in the chat room about online streaming and Netflix, which... Cameron Cat says, looks better on the Boxy Box than it does on the Roku. And that does bring up a very good point, which is that even if you have access to Netflix on one device and then another device and another device, and as we go along here, we have more and more devices that have access to online content, but they're not all created equal. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, that the Boxy Box might look better on Netflix than Roku. The user interface might be different. I believe Vudu does not even offer access to Netflix. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I think I saw something in the chat room about that. So that's another thing to keep in mind, is that different devices offer access to different content providers. And even if more than one device offers access to the same content provider, the experience will be different. So that's something you might want to check out online. Ask your friends who have streaming boxes. Read reviews and educate yourself as much as you can about which one is going to give you the best possible experience. I think we have time for one quick... Oh, we don't have time for one quick call. That'll be after the break. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And the music you're hearing now is the Dutch Tuba Quartet playing The Happy Soul, written by none other than my father, Robert Wilkinson. In his retirement, he was a musician for his whole life and taught me most of what I know about music. And in his retirement, he was a sax man himself, but he got into tuba quartets. And so he wrote something like 40 tuba quartets, of which this is one. So I'm very proud of him for that. And this is a traditional Jewish song, which he arranged for the quartet, and the Dutch tuba quartet, I think, did a great job on it. So let us go to Dale in Palmdale. Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek. Hey, Dale, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
Great, thanks. How can I help you?
Well, I had a question about the Pioneer Elite Curl. I'm in the market for buying a TV.
And you think you can find one?
Yeah, it's a Pioneer Elite Curl. It's a Pro 111 FD.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure, I mean, it's used, but the guy's moving back to Greece, so he can't take it with him. Getting a great deal on it, but I'm just wondering, should I look at this TV or should I look at a newer model, something that with the 3D or?
Well, I have to say that the Pioneer Curo is the finest looking flat panel TV I have ever seen. And
Ever seen,
period. End of story.
Wow.
I have one myself. So I can't recommend it highly enough. Do you know how many hours it has been watched?
No, I'm not sure of that, and I'm wondering if there's actually, can you go into the menu system and find that out?
You can, I believe. I don't recall exactly where in the menu system it is, but if you send me an email at scott@techguylabs.com,
okay,
I can go into my own Curo menu and find it. I don't remember exactly where it is. It's somewhere in there. You know, these plasmas are rated for, I don't remember what the Curos were exactly, but it's probably 50, 60,000 hours.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if it's, you know, got 1,000 hours on it, it's no big deal.
Right.
I have not seen a flat panel to equal the Curo yet.
This one here, was this the one that they came out with that was at the show that, you know, with that demonstration with the spinning ring?
I don't know that I know what you're talking about there, but it is the last generation of the Pioneer Curo. So I would definitely consider that, especially if you're getting a good deal on it. Is it a 50-inch?
Yeah, it's a 50-inch, and the guy wants $1,500 for it.
Yeah, well, they sold new, I don't remember exactly, but they were expensive, maybe $5,000. So
yeah, and even if you can pick up one now, they're still going for about almost 45 to 5.
Sure, if you can find a new one in the warehouse, in somebody's warehouse someplace. But yeah, I'd say absolutely.
Okay.
No reason not to.
Okay, well, thank you, Scott.
My pleasure.
Have a great day.
Yeah, thanks. You too.
Bye.
Okay, let's see here. We've got line 4. Dr. John in Long Beach. Scott Wilkinson here. How you doing?
Hi, Scott. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks. How can I help you?
Well, I've got a question regarding HDMI.
Oh, good question.
What we're trying to do is what I'm sure many consumers, prosumers, have a problem with, and that is getting the devices to talk to each other. I'll give you a case in point, and then I'll drop a bomb on you here in a minute, which will be fun.
Uh-oh.
No, seriously, it'll be great.
Okay. All right. I trust you.
Here's the issue. It's getting the devices to turn on, turn off, and my pet peeve is when I switch an input source on the TV from a tuner to, say, a Blu-ray. Now, the Blu-ray switches and switches the audio source. We're going through the receiver now. Let me clarify that for you.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that. It sounds like if you're switching inputs on the TV, you know, that's one thing, because what I would normally recommend is that you take all your sources through, connect them to your AV receiver, and then
that's what we've done. Yes.
So you have one HDMI cable going to your TV, and that's it. So you shouldn't have to switch inputs on your TV.
Okay. Well, and that's where we're running into problems, because that's what I've been doing, is switching inputs, then manually switching the source through the receiver. So we'll take the TV remote. We'll say, let's go to the satellite. In this case, it's the direct box with the HD DVR.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll go ahead and switch that. Then I've got to go onto my audio remote through the theater system and say, this is on this source, and press the appropriate button.
Oh, man, you're doing way too much work there.
That's exactly, that's exactly right. So what we want to do is streamline this. So help me, Scott, please. You're my only hope.
I think I can help you. Now, does your receiver, your AV receiver, have HDMI inputs?
Yes, it does. This is a really good quality Integra amplifier.
Oh, yeah. Great. Fantastic. Okay, well, then here's what I recommend.
Okay.
You take all your source devices, your Blu-ray player, your satellite box, whatever you have, connect them HDMI, their HDMI outs, into the HDMI ins of the receiver.
Which I think we've done, believe it or not.
Oh, well, then why are you switching inputs on your TV?
Because it will not do it for me, although what it will do is strange things like switch to the opposite. And in the menu system, we've got everything programmed appropriately. So we're going to go back and we're going to check everything over very carefully. But it's just a strange quirk. It's almost like there's a bug running around in there.
Well, it seems kind of weird. You know, what I would do is connect, as I said before, connect everything into the receiver.
Yes.
And then the receiver has an HDMI output.
Output.
And send that to the TV, say, just for sake of argument, HDMI 1. The TV probably has several HDMI inputs.
It does.
So you plug the receiver's HDMI output to HDMI 1, say, or whichever one of the inputs you have set up and calibrated and so on. Then you just pick which one you want to watch from the receiver. You tell the receiver, I want to watch the satellite box, and now I want to watch the Blu-ray player, and so on and so forth. And the receiver will do the switching and send whichever signal you select on the receiver to the TV, the video, I should say.
Okay.
And then the audio will just come out of the receiver and go to the speakers with one button push. So
okay.
I think that's a better solution.
Okay, we'll give it a check. Now, here's the bomb. My lovely wife, Robin, and I had a lovely chat with you at the NAB ham reception.
You're Dr. John. You're that Dr. John.
Yes, I am.
And well, fantastic.
We had a nice visit, Scott. It was great to visit with you and watch Leo take off at a runner's pace to wherever it was he was going. I think he had to catch a plane
back
to
town. He was catching
a
plane, yeah.
That was amazing.
For everybody else, what Dr. John is talking about here is that we were at the NAB show. And I was helping Leo cover that show for the TWiT Network. And one of the things we covered was a big party put on by Bob Heil, who makes the microphones for Leo Laporte. He's a great builder of microphones, but he's also a ham radio guy.
And he has Ham Nation on TWiT TV.
Has a brand new podcast on the TWiT Network called called Ham Nation.
Ham Nation, yes.
John, you're a big ham operator as well.
I'm a big ham. Am I an operator? Well, I've been married for a while now. So
yes, exactly. Well, thanks so much for calling, and I hope I was able to help.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This portion of the Tech Guy Show is brought to you by DSL Extreme. For really fast DSL internet access at an amazing price, use the service that Leo uses, DSL Extreme, at dslextreme.com. That bumper music is a tune called Threads of Friendship, written by my wife, Joanna Kasdan. I'm actually not playing on this particular cut, but it's a very nice fiddle tune that can be used for waltzes at contra dances, which we have done in the past, and so I thought I'd share a little bit of it with you now. And right now, I have a very special guest lined up to talk with us. His name is Eisuke Tsuyuzaki. He's the Chief Technology Officer of Panasonic North America, so he has an inside track on all things Panasonic. Hey, Eisuke, how are you?
Good morning or good afternoon, Scott. Hi.
I think it is. You're not entirely sure, are you? Because you just got back from Japan.
I did indeed. I'm always perpetually jet lagged, yeah.
So tell me, how are recovery efforts going in Japan now?
Thank you. I mean, it's getting a lot better, but there's still a lot of energy outages. As we go into the hot summer months, energy consumption is going to be difficult. That means it's going to be cutbacks for the industry as well. That's going to affect the supply chain. But it's getting remarkably better. It's, a lot of people are gritting their teeth, and yeah, it's going to all shake out.
Mm-hmm. And Panasonic is recovering its manufacturing and all of its infrastructure pretty well?
Pretty much. I mean, I think we talked a little bit about it last time. I think in a worst-case scenario, I think we've recovered about two-thirds. We haven't recovered everything, but we made some significant progress in the last few weeks.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, certainly my best wishes to you and everyone at Panasonic and everyone in Japan as they recover from this truly horrific catastrophe.
Thank you.
Now, I have to tell you that my first question about Panasonic out of the gate is one that I get. It's probably the most commonly asked question I get.
Okay.
Which is,
yep,
now that Panasonic has acquired Pioneer's plasma intellectual property and hired many of its plasma engineers, what are the company's plans to incorporate Kuro technology into its plasma TVs?
Okay. And you can obviously tell that I haven't talked to my PR people about this. I think this is one of the becoming one of these urban myths, as it were. As a matter of public record, we did hire a lot of people from Pioneer, and we did take acquire their patents in the plasma technologies. But that's about it. I mean, they're part of a much bigger team now that continues to refine and modify plasmas. And the emphasis, as I understand it, is focusing more of getting a better 3D experience, you know, less ghosting and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say it's from any particular company, any other particular technology per se, but we're trying to improve upon it. And I think that's the way we should leave it.
Yeah.
You know, I know there's a lot of discussions about it, but people making more than it should.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sorry to disappoint you there, Scott. But,
I'm sorry?
Sorry to disappoint you, but that's the reality. You know?
Well, that's what I want. I want the reality of the situation.
There you go.
And yeah. I will say that that the Panasonic plasmas that we have in the studio right now, the 2011 models,
mm-hmm.
look pretty good. The VT30, and particularly in terms of black level, which is really where Kuro was preeminent. But we've got these black levels on the Panasonic down close into Kuro territory. They're not all the way there, but they're almost there. And certainly the picture looks really, really good. And the 3D in particular looks good. And that was one of the other questions I wanted to ask you.
Okay.
Which is, what, in your view, is the adoption rate of 3D TVs? I hear, for example, that it's way ahead of where HD TV and Blu-ray were in their first year and a half.
It's actually one of the surprising things that the message isn't getting out there. In terms of the installed base, oh, gosh, you know, I forgot to check the latest numbers, but last year we ended up, where did we end up last year? A million, 5 million?
Yeah, something well over a million.
Yeah, something like that. And depending on who you talk to, I think it's about 3 to 5 million, something like that this year.
Mm.
So the install base continues to grow, Panasonic, but also others in terms of expanding their product ranges. So it will be if you buy a large flat panel TV, you're going to get a 3D and an IPTV functionality pretty much. It's given.
Anyway, right. That's what I've been saying all along, is that 3D is becoming essentially a feature.
And it's growing probably at the rate of 5 times the multiple of HD.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a significant sign on the hardware side. But, the disappointing thing about 3D is that there was a lot of excitement last year with the crescendo of Avatar and everything else. And then it's all about content now. And the content side, as you know so well, is growing. But there's also been some setbacks, like any new technology. But on the theatrical front, there hasn't been any, dare I say it, in the last 2 years, has there ever been a kind of a breakthrough, another 3D movie that's really kind of stood?
Another Avatar, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, there has been one of those to really drive it. The theatrical experiences are expensive. But on the broadcast side, I mean, you've got ESPN, you've got Discovery, you've got DirecTV, you've got Xfinity. Mostly these folks are doing VOD. And now you're beginning to see more linear channels, sports, movies, and then documentaries similar to an HD roll-up. So, you know, in a nutshell, I think we're still progressing at the rate of a multiple, at least two, probably three times the speed of HD, if that was any benchmark.
You mean in terms of programming rolling out?
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy to start a programming 3D. To create a channel, you probably need about 500 or 600 hours of programming. Not easy to do that. You can only license so much. It also helps that if some people actually make small professional 3D cameras.
Which Panasonic does.
And I think at an affordable level, Panasonic's the only one actually doing it. So it all helps. And the infrastructure is getting there. The education is getting there. The producers and directors, everyone is kind of, okay, it's 3D. Now I have to face it. What do I have to do? What are the aesthetics? What's the business model?
Now, Panasonic sponsors one 3D channel called N3D.
Yeah.
And I assume that we're, and that's on DirecTV, I believe?
That is on DirecTV. That's a Balka channel. It's a free channel. If you have an HD subscription, you can get access to that for free.
And is it 24/7 3D?
It is 24/7. They may be repeating a few things, but it is 24/7. And there's also a couple of VOD offerings as well.
Now, I know that Panasonic, in addition to making TVs and doing this 3D channel, has also been involved in shooting some 3D footage. I know that, for example, a Panasonic camera has gone or will go up in one of the last shuttles and shoot some 3D footage aboard the shuttle and in the space station. What can you tell us about that?
You're on the board there. Yeah, it will be on the last shuttle. It will be as part of the document from the inside, as it were, the last manned space flight for some time. And we'll also have the cameras, the laptops, and all the other audiovisual things that go around it to document this whole thing.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
No, that's exciting.
Now, at NAB, you hinted to me that we might see something special with the 2012 Olympics in 3D.
Is there anything, did I know? Yeah.
Is there anything you can tell me about that?
Well, look, I think you should try to put the dots together. And, well, we are sponsors of the Olympic Games for 2012 and beyond.
I think we have to put those dots together. And thank you so much, Eisuke Tsuyuzaki, the Chief Technology Officer of Panasonic North America. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And the bumper music you're hearing right now was written by my good friend Jeff Rona for the 2008 Beijing Olympics. And since we were talking just a moment ago with Eisuke Tsuyuzaki about the 2012 Olympics, we thought it would be appropriate to play a little bit of this here. And what is my involvement with this music, you may ask? Well, the call that you hear right about here, that is me playing conch shell trumpet. So if you have an image of the South Sea Islander with his big conch shell, or this is actually a tradition all over the world. It's in Nepal, it's in Mexico, it's all over the place, and you cut off the end of the conch shell, make a little trumpet mouthpiece out of it, and you can blow these great calls that are heard over miles and miles. And so I went into the studio and recorded some blasts of the conch shell trumpet, and Jeff Rona incorporated them into his music which was played at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. So, as I said, all day today we're playing bumper music that that I have been involved in one way or another, for the most part. And so I hope you are enjoying that. Let's get right back to the phones here. I think Robert in Washington, D.C. has been waiting the longest. Hey, Robert, it's Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek.
Hi, Scott. I'm in the process of replacing an old 3300 from Denon. For the obvious reason, doesn't have HDMI.
Oh, yeah. It's good to have HDMI these days.
Yeah. And I know it's a 5.1, and I heard that there's not much content takes event at 7.1, but the fact is you can't get the old 5.1 receivers anyway.
not except at the very low end of the spectrum. That's true.
Yeah. Well, right now I know you speak a lot about the Onkyo models.
Certainly, the Onkyo and Integra receivers are very good. I particularly like their home theater in a box systems, which include the speakers and the receiver and everything all together, but that's not what you're talking about.
Yeah, there was one that came out recently, which is, I haven't been out that long, is I think the NR-809.
The 809, a very excellent product, absolutely, TX-NR-809.
Yeah, but there's also one that I was sort of looking at before, that was the Pioneer Elite series.
Also very good. Also very good receivers. I like the Pioneer Elites quite a bit. I like the Onkyos quite a bit. I like the Denons quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm coming for Denons. Like, as far as sound goes, and because all of them, you know, I know that the SR, I know among the Pioneer Elite, there's an SC35 and 37.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the 35 has network capabilities.
I don't remember exactly now. I do know that the Pioneer Elite SC series, I'm pretty sure, uses Class D amplification. Mm-hmm. So that's a sort of a digital amplifier, which is different than a traditional analog amplifier.
Have you yourself compared the DS, that particular receiver with any of the Onkyos?
Not directly, no. I will say that some people really like the sound of Class D amplification and some people really don't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit more of a risk. I happen to really like the sound of the Pioneer SC. I have one, I don't remember, it's the SC25 maybe. In our studio.
Is that SC25 you said?
I believe so, yeah. I don't remember the exact model. I think it's a 25. That it has Class D amp, and boy, I just think it sounds really great. Very clean, really very nice. But there are people who really disagree with me, and it's a matter of taste at that point.
And you said the Onkyo. Because the Onkyo's in it. I have a Denon right now, but I mean, the Denon seems to be more gimmicky sometimes than the other ones. That's what I was wondering about.
Oh, well, I mean, it depends on the features that you want. Also, most of these receivers now have online access to content as well as Blu-ray players and TVs. So, you know, it depends on if you want that or not. Denon has always, I've always thought they rated very highly in terms of sound quality.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't hesitate to recommend Denon products or Pioneer.
Say that they're probably on the same, the Onkyos and the Denons are probably at the same level then?
Roughly speaking, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that the Pioneers may be a little better if you like that particular amp.
Yeah, certainly the Elites, if you like that Class D amplifier sound, which I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just to get your opinion on those particular models.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you that I've looked at them directly or listened to them directly, compared one to the other, but unfortunately I haven't. I don't think you can go wrong.
But you've heard of 25, though. And
Oh, yeah. I use it as a reference piece in my theater, so... In my testing room, anyway, not in my. I do have a Pioneer receiver in my theater as well. It's a little bit older, my own home theater at home. But in my testing room, I have an SC25, and I like it a lot.
Okay.
Thanks so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
So I think we have something coming up here, a little message from Leo Laporte himself.
I do want to mention Nod 32. This is how you protect your computer from the beasties, the bugs, the viruses that are out there. And if you are using a Mac, you don't have to feel left out. Yes, they're coming for you, too. And ESET, the company that makes the great Nod 32 antivirus, also makes now a cybersecurity program for the Mac called, interestingly enough, ESET Cybersecurity for Mac. It is, you could try it free right now. Go to www.eset.com/Mac, and you get it free for 30 days. If you want the Windows products, it's ESET.com/Leo. In either case, you can also call them, 866-935-ESET. Just make sure you mention me. The nice thing about these antiviruses, first of all, I've tried them all. I can highly recommend them. These are effective. They're good. They're real. They're fast. They don't slow your system down. And they are the most effective scanners out there. Plus, they have advanced heuristics. This is important on the Mac, which will catch virus-like activity before it happens. And on the Mac especially, that's really important. Because if you do get attacked on the Mac, chances are it's an attack targeting you, your business, for instance. An email that's crafted to get you. And that's not going to be an email that's going to show up in the signature database. That's going to be something they're going to have to catch because of how it's behaving. Nobody does it better than cybersecurity for the Mac. ESET.com/Mac. And by the way, don't forget to like ESET USA on Facebook. You can stay looped in on their contest, special offers, and exclusive content. If you use Windows or Mac, you need ESET.
Okay, we're back. Thanks so much, Leo, for telling us about Nod 32. Let's see, who's next on the line? It is Stephen in Sherman Oaks. Hey, Stephen, you're on the show.
Yes, hi.
How can I help you?
Hey, so I have a question about wireless speakers.
Oh, yeah.
We just redid our backyard, and so nice. We have a jacuzzi and a pergola, and we basically mounted a projector on the pergola, which is like a big open gazebo.
Yeah, sure.
And we have a full empty side of our house that's 30 feet away, and we set up a projector to show movies. So you sit in the jacuzzi, and you watch movies in the jacuzzi on the side of the house.
Sounds delightful.
So the question is, we really want to get wireless speakers that we can mount on the side of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've been bringing out like big studio monitors and stuff, and it's just kind of a pain. So we have the DVD player that's right next to the projector that's about 30 feet away from the house. So the question is, what can we do to get speakers there, and which would good speakers be, and just what's the whole deal with it?
Well, there are several ways to do it. There are companies that make wireless speakers, and I'm thinking in particular, I answered a question on this on ultimateavmag.com, and I'm trying to look it up here so that I can make sure I remember correctly. I believe it's Aperion Audio makes a wireless speaker. I believe it's called the Zona, and I'm still trying to find it here. It's actually, you know, I answer a question a day on Ultimate AV Mag, so it takes a little while. And then it might have been on hometheater.com. So I'll say this. I'll go from memory as best I can. The Aperion Audio Zona speaker is a totally wireless speaker, meant to be used originally for surround sound, but I think it can work perfectly well as a front speaker. You plug a transmitter into the source device, which in this case would be, I guess, the DVD player, the analog line output of the DVD player, into this little transmitter, and then it transmits wireless signal to these speakers, which you have to plug into the wall. They have their own amplifier built in and their own wireless receiver. So they don't need an audio cable, but they need a power cable. And that's the thing you have to keep in mind. With all wireless type systems, there has to be power to these wireless speakers for them to operate. So hopefully you have an outlet near where you want them to be. But that would be one good solution. Another solution is, there are a couple. One's available from Atlantic Technology, and Aperion also makes one, although I've seen on their website that it's currently unavailable until the next generation comes out in August. So those don't have speakers. They're just wireless transmission audio systems. So I hope that answers the question. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, 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 it's Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, sitting in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. During the week when I'm not doing this, you can find me online at ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. You can also listen to my podcast on the Twit Network. It's called Home Theater Geeks. What else? I have a different guest geek each week. It records on Mondays from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. That's 4:30 to 5:30 Eastern. And you can watch us record the show live at live.twit.tv or find the audio and video podcast the next day or so at twit.tv/htg on iTunes or on ultimateavmag.com. So we're taking a bunch of questions today, and I'm really happy to be doing that. It's one of my favorite things to do. In fact, I answer listener and reader questions on ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com every week. And you can email me at scott@techguylabs.com. Or you can call me right now at 8888-ASK-LEO. That's 888-827-5536. Now, later this hour, at the bottom of the hour, I've got another really special guest, Henry Jackman, a film composer who has written the score for X-Men First Class, Gulliver's Travels, Monsters vs. Aliens, and he's currently working on Puss in Boots, the next spinoff from the Shrek universe. So that's going to be really interesting, and I'm looking forward to speaking with him. But in the meantime, we will take some more calls, and let's see. I think I heard that Philip in San Francisco has been waiting the longest. Hey, Philip, you're on with Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek. Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call. In the year 2000, I bought a 3-CRT tube Mitsubishi 73-inch 1080i rear projection TV.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, some of the reviews said that it worked almost as good as some $25,000 three-tube CRT front projectors. I liked the picture. Mm-hmm. My question is, today, if I bought their latest either 73 or 82-inch rear projection, would that one DLP machine that's used in the Mitsubishi give me as good a picture as I have on my three-tube CRT that's 10 years old?
Well, that is a really, really good question. The short answer is yes and no. Of course.
In terms of resolution, what would you?
In terms of resolution, I suspect you would probably have a better experience with the newer set.
But we're splitting hairs, you're saying.
I think we're splitting hairs a little bit. I mean, your TV currently can only accept a 1080i signal. The I stands for interlaced. Now, most broadcast HD TV is broadcast in an interlaced format, so you're not losing anything there. It depends on how good the TV's de-interlacer is, and I don't even know if it has a de-interlacer. It might, in fact, being that old, display the interlaced fields separately, sequentially, as older CRT TVs used to do. Now, for those who don't understand that, the broadcaster is sending, first of all, the odd-numbered lines, line number one, line number three, line number five, seven, nine, and so on, followed by the even-numbered lines, line number two, four, six, eight, and so on. All modern TVs take those two what are called fields, the odd-numbered fields, the odd-numbered lines in one field, field one, and the even-numbered lines in the second field, field two, and they combine them together and display them all at once. And it takes a video processor to do that, and some video processors do that job better than others. But in the old CRT days, they actually displayed the information, one field followed by the other, and they depended upon the human being's persistence of vision to meld the two together into a single frame.
Yeah.
So if you get a DLP TV, it's going to certainly de-interlace anything coming in 1080i. and it may do a good job or it may not. However, I will also say that we now have Blu-ray, which we didn't in 2000. And Blu-ray sends its information to the TV at 1080p. That is, all of the lines
right
all at once. And that your TV undoubtedly cannot accept that.
No.
And you really want...
I've enjoyed, though, the progressive scan on regular DVDs, and it does a nice job.
Well, that's that. Yes, regular DVD progressive scan is called 480p, so it has much less resolution.
Right.
Now, your TV might be doing another process called upscaling, which takes 480p, which has a pixel resolution of, I believe it's about 720 wide by 480 tall, and converts that to 1920 wide by 1080 or 1080 tall. And again, the video processor might do that well, or it might do it poorly. Does a upscaled, or a, I'm sorry, a progressive DVD coming from your DVD player, does that fill the entire screen?
Oh, yes.
It does. Okay, so your TV is doing an what's called upscaling, and you like the way that picture looks.
It's good, but I haven't experienced, Blu-ray, and well, I want to
yeah.
get it.
Yeah, see, you're gonna see a real difference, because even though you upscale DVD to, the TV is upscaling DVD to its native resolution, you're not really seeing high def. What it's doing is...
Well, let me ask you, because...
Yeah, sure.
This way. If I did get the new DLP version, it probably would be sharper.
Oh, no question.
Have all the benefit of Blu-ray that I can use and so on and so forth.
Yep.
I have one final quickie.
Yep.
If we were to compare that Mitsubishi with, let's say I project, use a front projector, and it's 73 or 82 inch, let's say 82, 82 inch model.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the JVC DILA projector, their reference grade RU 36 or something like that, that uses the DILA.
It's a fabulous projector.
Would it be a much better picture, or would we still be splitting hairs a little, but you're paying so you have the knowledge you've got something better than the next?
Well, what I would say on that score is, with a rear projector, a rear projection DLP TV from Mitsubishi, you'd be able to use it a lot easier in a room with light. The front projector you would have to use in a very dark room.
Sure, but would there be a wow factor in comparison? It's clearly a more expensive option.
Yes, it is.
But is it going to still be splitting hairs? And
well, you know, that depends on who you talk to. The JVC projectors are really fabulous, so I can really recommend them very highly. The Mitsubishi TVs are also very good. I would say, in your case, I'm guessing, based upon talking with you, that it probably would be a little bit of splitting hairs. Also, it depends on the amount of real estate, floor space you have, you know, because the Mitsubishi is going to take up a lot of floor space.
Yes.
And the projector's not, particularly if you can hang it from the ceiling.
Right.
But again, the projector's going to need a dark room to watch, ideally.
Yeah, but my main point is how much more would I be getting in terms of picture quality if I went?
I think you would be probably happy either way.
Okay.
I would venture to guess that you would be happy either way. So I would say go forth and get a good screen. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The music you're hearing now is my group Many Axes. It's an avant-garde trio, Only three of us, but we play many, many different instruments, hence the name of the group, Many Axes. In this particular cut, I'm playing something called a harmonic flute, which is a flute with no finger holes, only a hole at the end. And you play different notes by going up and down the harmonic scale, blowing your air more or less, and closing the end hole or not. So Susan Rockliffe is playing didgeridoo and screaming around a lot, and Brad Dutz is playing one of his many, many drums. And that is kind of an exciting little piece on our first album, I believe, eponymously called Many Axes. But for now, let's get right back to the phones. I have Carol in Orlando. Hey, Carol, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
Doing great, thanks.
I have an odd-shaped room where I watch TV.
Mm-hmm.
There's a closet from another room that juts out in one end of the room, and I have vaulted ceilings.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, me too. So when I'm listening to the TV, I can actually hear it better if I go stand in my kitchen. So I was just wondering, is there a speaker system that tends to fill up the room better with sound more than another system? Or
boy, that's a tough one. I might suggest that you try a sound bar. We were talking about that earlier in the
uh-huh.
show. You know, sound coming from, do you have a 5.1 system now?
Yes.
Okay. And have you been able to find good places for the surround speakers in particular?
Yeah, they are right behind me. I think it's because of the vaulted ceilings, I'm assuming.
That can certainly be a problem, yeah.
Yeah. And the front speakers, you know, I am situated where I should be according to all the diagrams that they, I don't know if it's because this closet that juts out next to me blocks some of it, or if it all ends up, you know, up in the ceiling area.
Well, it could very well be. And the best solution might be, you know, to do some acoustical treatments.
Uh-huh.
And that can get expensive because you don't want to necessarily do that yourself unless you know what you're doing.
Right.
Which means you would probably hire somebody, and that would be something. Now, you're in Orlando, you say?
Yes.
So I might suggest that you go to the website Cedia, CEDIA.net, I believe. I'll have to look and double-check on that. But if you just Google Cedia, CEDIA, you'll find it. And they list Cedia installers. People who they have certified as custom installers. CEDIA stands for Custom Electronics Design and Installation Association.
Okay.
And so they specialize in custom installed home theaters. Now, you don't want somebody to come in and do a total custom install. You just want somebody to come in and maybe do a little acoustical analysis and figure out what you can do to improve the sound. That's what a lot of people don't realize, is that the room is as much a component of your home theater system,
right,
as the TV and the speakers and the AVR and all that stuff. So I'm afraid that's probably my best recommendation at this point, if you want to really improve the sound of that room, which is an unfortunate room.
Mm-hmm.
And you know you're going to have to do something about it. Probably you're going to have to do something about the room, and I don't think that you could get much better with a different speaker or a sound bar or something else.
Okay, and I have the VT25. I got it a few months ago, and I think it's great.
Excellent, excellent. I love that TV. That is a wonderful TV. So congratulations on that.
All right, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, let's see. I got Charles in San Diego, one of my favorite towns. Hey, Charles, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I want to get this question in for my battery. It tells me to get lost.
Uh-oh.
On my Bluetooth.
I've been there.
We have a Samsung 52-inch LED. Turned it on last night, and on the left part of the screen is a vertical line changing colors, things
Ooh.
Like that. This morning, the line is, when the TV comes on, it's black, changes to blue and to white, and then it goes rainbow colors. I did some looking on the internet. It says something about a T-Con box, possibly.
The T-Con box. I don't know what that is.
Neither do I, but, it's kind of disappointing. It's a Samsung, and it's...
How old is the TV?
According to them, 3 years old.
3 years old. Well, that's not too bad. Maybe somebody in the chat room knows of the T-Con box. I don't know.
There are no places down here to repair it. So
yeah.
I'm gonna look around. Is that about the lifespan of these things?
Oh, it should be longer than that. Unfortunately, it's probably out of warranty.
And I don't think the wife got that good deal when she purchased it.
Okay. All right. It does sound like it's going bad, if you ask me. I'm sorry to say it. It's going to need some technician repair, some technician love, as they say. It sounds like something's gone bad there.
What would you recommend as an alternative to Samsung? I guess that's the...
Well, Samsung makes a great product. They don't make rear projectors anymore. You said this was a rear projector, right?
No, sir.
Oh, it's a, is it a plasma or an LCD?
LCD.
My mistake. I apologize. Samsung makes a great product. What's the model number?
It's pretty long. LN52 Alpha. 5503PF is all I was able to get off the back of it.
Okay. LN, you said.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Samsung TVs are generally very good. I recommend them highly. You've got one with a conventional backlight, which is neither here nor there, but it does sound like a fault to me. It sounds like something has gone wrong. Samsung's a great brand, generally speaking. These things occasionally happen, and I don't know there's much you can do about it other than take it into a certified tech and see what they tell you. Of course, they're going to charge you for diagnosis, and it's going to be, that's going to be, they'll apply it to the repair if you want to get it repaired, but it should last longer than 3 years. That's not reasonable to expect a TV only to last 3 years.
Okay.
So good luck to you.
All right. Thank you much, sir. I appreciate it.
You bet. Okay. Let's see. We got 1 minute left. I think let's try and sneak in one more call here. Rob in Riverview, Florida. Scott Wilkinson, the Home Theater Geek. How you doing?
Hey, Scott. How you doing, buddy?
Great. Thanks. How can I help you?
Real quick. I have the Vision Max HD 4K LCD projector.
Okay.
And I'm just, it was basically kind of given, sold to me, a trade-off or a debt.
Okay.
And I'm trying to see what it's worth. It's brand new.
You said Vision Max was the brand?
Yes.
I don't know that brand. It's not one of the home theater brands.
It looks, I got it with the screen, and I looked it up online. It was about $8,000.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's a 3D.
Really?
Yes, LCD projector, HD 4K. And I looked it up two ways to Monday, and I'm like, wow.
Well, let me take a quick look here. We may run out of time, so if we do, I will. In fact, we have run out of time. Let me look that up at the break and get back to you online. Keep listening. This is Scott Wilkinson, the Home Theater Geek, in for Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. This is Scott Wilkinson, the Home Theater Geek, sitting in for Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. And the music you're hearing right now is from X-Men First Class, composed by Henry Jackman, who is my very special guest right about now. Henry, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you. I saw X-Men, and a wonderful movie. I can recommend it highly. I really do like the X-Men franchise, and this latest movie is a great one, and the music is fantastic. Thank you so much. It's just a great job.
Well, thanks for saying that. I mean, it's always a tough gig doing, composing scores for movies, but a superhero movie and something with that amount of music and with a history to the franchise, it's an extra challenge. So
yeah. Well, listen, how much music is there in X-Men First Class?
It is a daunting 113 minutes, which I can tell you, when you start a film and you sort of put the chart on the wall and look at it, you just think, my word, that looks like Mount Everest.
Wow, the total movie's only, what, 120-something?
Well, at a certain point, we have an expression, wall to wall, you know.
Yeah.
By the time you get to, there's all that great action pretty much towards the end of the movie, and there's a certain point where, you know, you just can't. You can't let anyone off the hook. It's just got to keep cranking.
Man. So give us a real brief overview of the process of writing a score for a movie. When do you get involved? How long does it take?
You know, each one is completely different. But there's the general principle is that, you know, let the director get a first cut that he's happy with. So at least there is a movie to talk about. There's a movie that you know, it's got all kinds of things that still need to happen, like the special effects and the sound effects and ADR and all kinds of things. But essentially, there is something you can sit down and talk about. And you have a spotting session. You sit down with the director, the producers, and, you know, you talk through it. And more than anything, you're trying to identify what are the main themes you're going to need, which in X-Men wasn't too difficult, because it's pretty clear. I mean, I'm not going to give too much away, but anyone who's seen the film realizes that the Eric Magneto character, and I think I just caught you playing a little bit of it before I came on air, you know, that was always going to need its own thing. X-Men obviously have a theme, but that was also a tiny bit tricky because there have been these other three films, but there was no onus on me to take, you know, an X-Men theme from the other films. I was
going to ask if there was any intention or tendency to want to take some musical themes from the previous movies, or did you start with a clean slate?
Well, you know, we started with a clean slate, and that's no, I mean, the previous composers to X-Men movies reads like a list of, you know, who's who of brilliant composers. You got Michael Kamen, John Ottman, John Powell. I mean, and Harry Gregson Williams, of course, did Wolverine. I mean, there's no what they're doing. It wasn't anything to do with any feeling like we needed to move away from anything, but Matthew Vaughn is such a, I wouldn't say it's a reboot, but because it's a prequel, and Matthew Vaughn brings to the film his own shtick. In a funny way, as I was composing the themes for it, it's almost like he sort of protected me from worrying too much. You know, I wasn't doing endless research on the previous scores. He managed to sort of create an environment that made it feel like how you'd approach any other movie, regardless of the fact that it is within, you know, a franchise. Now, it's not to say, obviously, I know all the other X-Men movies really well, but it was more like a sort of background influence than some sort of slavish, you know, it's not like, well, we must take the Kamen theme and
modern. Right, sure. So how long did it take from the moment you got the first rough cut and took a look at it and came in for the spotting session to the finished product?
A frighteningly short amount of time. Funny thing is, I was probably thinking about it a lot before I could do. I mean, I remember saying, "Right, come on, then let's go through this." But Matthew said, "Wait, hold on, I'm not happy with the cut. I'm not happy with the cut yet." So the actual distance of launching into full battle may have been a little shorter than normal. Still, plenty enough time to do it. But under the bonnet, what you find is, you know, weeks before that and months before that, knowing as you do the script and in conversations with the director, you just start the kind of seeds of, there's a difference between not thinking it, having any ideas at all, and having just a sort of fetal idea in your head of what needs to happen. That's useless, because you've got an idea of something, which when you play it to the director, he goes, no,
I don't want that.
Actually, there was a bit of that on X-Men. The very first pieces I wrote were in a much more sweeping, I think it may have been because I'd just finished Gulliver's Travels. It was more of a traditional sort of symphonic approach, because two of my heroes, Alan Silvestri and John Williams.
Yeah.
And when I played it to him, I had that interesting experience of when you play something in the company of someone else, particularly the film director, and we both looked at it and we're like, it's good music, but I think we need something. There's something about this X-Men film now. It's coming into its own, and that you feel the sort of the youth of it. We're going to need a different tone. It can't be a straight up and down symphonic score. And that's when all the guitars started happening, you know. And
well, I was going to ask you about the balance of a live orchestra versus say synthesized. I know that you've done a lot of synthesis work on program, like for example The Dark Knight. You were the synth programmer for that, so I'm curious about, you know, sort of the mix between live musicians and synthesizers, which are played by live musicians, but they're ultimately, you know, a synthesized sound rather than violins and trumpets and so on.
No, sure. It's an interesting topic in film music. I mean, I'm a bit schizophrenic because I had a sort of very, very straight-laced upbringing in terms of classical training. I went to sort of, you know, borderline monasterial choir. You know, I was playing Brahms and Beethoven in an orchestra when I was 14, and it was all looking like I was going to be a sort of pianist and an organist at, you know, some King's College, Cambridge, la-di-da-di-da.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I sort of veered off quite severely left when dance music sort of was the craze in England and really started getting to samplers and synthesizers. And so I'm in a sort of lucky place where I love straight up and down traditional classical symphonic music just as much as I love dubstep or drum and bass or, and you know, I'm as long as something's imaginative and well done, I don't really mind. So I don't find it a huge... Once I've sort of figured out what I'm doing with the film, I don't mind, you know, something like Winnie the Pooh, there's not a synthesizer to be seen. And it, you know, it sounds like music more influenced by, you know, Western classical music. And then on the other hand, with X-Men, like when you're asking about the balance, you know, there's a fully recorded symphony orchestra, but there's all kinds of other stuff going on in there. You know, right. There's a lot of weird atmospheric noises and, you know, the drums aren't exactly acoustically recorded, you know. It's,
right.
There's all sorts of programming and stuff. And I, if anything, having the two together in a single movie is more challenging than either very heavy electronic or very heavy orchestra. Careful, you can get a slightly naff sound. If you, the sound of an orchestra with not particularly well, if the hybrid isn't carefully judged, you can be a bit naff.
Oh, that's very interesting. Sure. So you got to really kind of mix them carefully.
I think so, yeah. Otherwise, you're in that potentially dangerous territory of every now and then you'll get a sort of crossover classical artist who's sort of busy singing Ness and Dormer, and there's a sort of not exactly done by the Chemical Brothers or Daft Punk, you know, right. Who doesn't know that much about electronic music. You've got to navigate that area. Okay, if that's not to say, it's a lot of, I mean, Harry, for instance, he does a good job at that. There's plenty of Harry Gregson-Williams scores that have a really nice blend of, and John Powell. Well, obviously Hans Zimmer. I mean, look at The Dark Knight.
Oh yeah. Oh, seriously.
He invented it. I mean, he's the master.
Yeah.
But in fact, you could argue historically, he's the guy who sort of brought that to the table. If you look at the history of film scores, once Hans started up, you know, once he was up and running through the 90s and the noughties or whatever you want to call them, you know, there was this new language. It wasn't necessarily just purely symphonic.
Yes, yes. And I know you've worked with Hans Zimmer on many occasions.
Yeah, yeah. I used to, in fact, I'm probably about 40 feet away from him now. I'm just coming up with a theme for Puss in Boots. I think
right. I was going to ask you about your upcoming projects, Puss in Boots being one of them you're working on right now, huh?
Exactly. Case in point in terms of, you know, mixing and matching styles, influences and stuff. You couldn't get much more difference between X-Men and Puss in Boots. There's, you know, there's no pounding production or sort of Cuban missiles.
Well, at that, I'm afraid we have to leave it. Thank you so much, Henry Jackman, for being on the show. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This portion of the Tech Guy Show is brought to you by Carbonite. If you want to get it back, you gotta back it up with Carbonite. This is Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek, in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And I got a little distracted there with my wife, Joanna Kasdan, singing her song from our album, Living Through History. It's actually not called Mysterious. It's called... No End to Love. It took me a second to call that up. The music was written by John Strauss, who in fact was the music editor on Amadeus, and Joanna wrote the lyrics, and I'm playing 8 different woodwind parts, all synthesized, which I was very proud of, because I was using a particular synthesizer that I think works very well for wind instruments, and just in the last segment, I was talking with Henry Jackman about synthesizers in movie scores, and here they are in the album that we recorded quite some years ago now. Just wanted to touch base about one of the last callers we had who mentioned the Vision Max projector. which he had gotten in payment for some work. And it was the HD 4K, and I'd never heard of it before. And went online, took a look. A lot of people in the chat room were also doing some research for me. Thank you so much, those of you in the chat room, which Leo calls his brain, and I now see why. And it looks to me like it's not the most kosher of things. It is what some people in the chat room are calling a white van brand, okay? So maybe a scam, something I'd never heard of before. It's certainly not 4K resolution. I don't know why they called it that. And I don't know anything about it, but I would be skeptical, shall we say. So I just wanted to let you know about that. We do have one call in from Eau Claire. Dan from Eau Claire. Scott Wilkinson, the home theater geek. Welcome.
Hi, Scott. Dan, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. How are you?
I'm doing just great. How about yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. How can I help you?
Well, I had a quick question for you. I'm finishing up a media room in my basement. And I'm looking at surround sound options. My wife doesn't want a lot of wires. She doesn't like a lot of speakers hanging around. I have a wave radio, a Bose wave radio that I use upstairs in my living room. And it's good for a shelf system. And I was wondering about a series, the Series 3 or even maybe the Series 5 with like the Acoustimass module, something that would work in a smaller space without a lot of speakers.
Sure.
And I know Sony, a lot of other companies do similar types of things, small speakers, satellite.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your opinion maybe you might be on?
Well, Bose does some things really well. For example, their noise-canceling headphones, which I love. I have the Quiet Comfort 15s, and I wear them on the plane anytime I fly. And they sound great, and they reduce noise very well. The Wave radio is pretty impressive. For a little tabletop radio, it sounds pretty good.
For what it is, I'm very happy with it.
Now, having said that, I will tell you that I am not a big fan of Bose surround sound home theater type systems. I think you can do a lot better. For one thing, they're very expensive.
Right.
And you're buying the name as much as the product.
Gotcha.
So I would say I would not recommend that. If you're looking for like a home theater in a box kind of situation, it sounds to me like that may be what you're looking for.
Only because I've been leaning towards the Bose, only because it comes with a few, I don't know, three speakers. I mean, the Acoustimass and like two speakers or three speakers. There's not a lot of stuff, and that's what my wife doesn't want, is a lot of stuff.
Mm, well, I can understand that.
Along those lines.
She would not accept having surround speakers on the sides of the room?
I don't know. I think I got to work on running the speakers. I don't want to do a whole lot of work here either, you know?
Yeah, but you want a good experience, don't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Well, in terms of home theaters in a box, I've always recommended Onkyo. They always make a very nice product, really good sounding, really good performing. It comes with a receiver and a set of speakers and a subwoofer.
Okay.
It does not typically, I think the Onkyos don't come with a Blu-ray player, so...
That's good. That's the other thing, the reason I steered away from that stuff is because they come with all these other things I already have.
Yeah, well, if you already have a Blu-ray player, then the Onkyo is a great choice.
Okay, all right.
Great choice. I would say absolutely. I have no trouble recommending that whatsoever.
Outstanding.
So that's what I would do.
Perfect. That sounds good. I'll check it out. Thank you for your recommendations, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
You bet. My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yep, have a good one.
Thanks, you too. Okay, let's see. I got one more call here. Charles, don't know. Oh, Leo. That's right. We got to hear from Leo first. Sorry. Yeah, let's hear from Leo.
You know about me and Carbonite. We go back a long ways. In fact, when Abby went to college, she's a freshman. First thing I did when I gave her, give her the laptop for college, right? And I didn't even ask her. I just put Carbonite on there. See, here's the thing. In fact, Carbonite was invented by David Friend. He's a CEO for his college-bound daughter who... Well, it was actually her second year. In year one, she lost her thesis. She wrote a paper, and she called, Daddy, what do you do? And he said, there's got to be a better backup solution. So he created Carbonite. But Carbonite, whenever your laptop or computer is online, is backing up. And it's backing up to the internet. So even if you lose the computer or even lose your backups, you've always got a good, safe copy up there in the cloud. And you can get to it anytime. You don't have to wait for the worst to happen. You just log on to your Carbonite account with any computer. Go to the library, log on there. Use an iPhone and a BlackBerry, an Android phone, log on there, and there's your file. It's always ready, always available. It's just great. Try it free for 15 days. Carbonite.com. Use the offer code Leo. If you decide to buy, use my name Leo again. You'll get 2 months for the price of 12. Two months free. 14 months for the price of 12. Wouldn't be a good deal if you got 2 months for the price of 12. 14 months for the price of 12. That's two free months. And by the way, Carbonite, they just hired 250 people in Lewiston, Maine. They've moved their tech support out of India to the U.S. I love them for that. Thank you, Carbonite. And that, of course, means you're going to get great support from them if you need it. Carbonite.com. You got to back it up to get it back. So do it right with Carbonite.
Thanks so much, Leo. I couldn't agree more. Got to back it up if you're going to get it back. Let's see. We've got a few minutes left. I'm going to go to line two with Charles. Hey, Charles, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. I have a quick question about 3D Blu-ray players.
One of my favorite subjects.
Okay. I went to the store to buy one, and the salesperson told me that it has to specifically say 3D on it for it to play the version. But I remember I have the oldest PlayStation 3.
Mm-hmm.
There's no 3D label on it, and it plays the 3D Blu-rays.
It does. PlayStation 3 is interesting and possibly unique in that it can be updated to play 3D.
Okay.
So if you already have a PlayStation 3 and you've got the latest firmware, it should play 3D just fine, and you don't need to buy another 3D Blu-ray player.
Okay. What if I need a tabletop 3D player? I mean, Blu-ray player. Does it have to say 3D on it? The regular ones won't play 3D, right?
That's correct. That's correct. A Blu-ray player that doesn't say 3D on the box or on the player probably won't play 3D, but there are certainly so many of them these days. Most of them probably do, so just look for that 3D and you'll be fine.
Pretty good. That's all I had.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, so we are rapidly running out of time here. The time has gone so fast, and I want to thank everyone who called in and everyone in the chat room. Been just great. Kyle at the board and Aaron on the phones have just been wonderful and made my job so much easier. You can read my stuff, which I post every day, at ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com. You can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Don't forget to tune into my Home Theater Geeks podcast this coming Monday, that is tomorrow. My guest geek is Chris Conacher of computeraudiophile.com, talking about high-quality audio from your computer. You can watch us record the show live at live.twit.tv, or find the audio and video podcast the next day or two at twit.tv/htg. on iTunes or on ultimateavmag.com. We record that show Monday at 1:30 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. That's 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. And so I sure hope you will join me for that. I do have one other musical selection I'd love to play if we have just a second, which is the blues number on, I threw Kyle a curveball here, but since we do have a couple minutes, I believe it's track number 2 on my wife's and my CD called Living Through History. This one's called Trouble in Mind, and the reason I wanted to play it is that it's got me playing a little blues trombone. Of course, we have no trouble in mind here. We have nothing but blue skies and home theater dreams. Thank you so much, everybody. Geek out.